Good morning. This year, we are going through a special theme on being conquerors. The theme is called The One Who Conquers, and each week so far this year, we've been talking about how we can win that battle, how we are fighting this against the enemy, Satan, and it's difficult, it's a battle, and it's going to take some work and effort. And in the end, we're going to conquer. Now, we've been doing that through the book of Revelation, and we've been looking at different churches and how some of them did well with that and some didn't do so well. And last week, we began talking about the church in Laodicea with what we titled Conquering with Zeal. That was what the church didn't have. This was a church that Jesus said, you aren't cold, you aren't hot, instead you're right in the middle, you're lukewarm, and lukewarm I spit out of my mouth. And so here was a church that was not on fire for Jesus at all. This was a church that was just kind of bleh. And Jesus said, that's not what my people are, that's what I spit out, I don't have any use for that. And so we talked about how can we have that burning fire for Christ? How can we really have that kind of a zeal? And we talked last week a little bit about cultivating that through our focusing our devotion towards Him and how we can really cultivate that fire. I want to talk about that some more this morning. One of the problems that the church in Laodicea had was that they didn't see things right. Remember what we talked about last time? They thought, I'm rich, I have everything, and they didn't see that, you know, there's a whole, I don't have anything. So a lot of it was with what they saw. Now, a lot of times what causes our lack of zeal is that we don't see things right. If we could really see the spiritual battle that we were going through, I think that would fill us with a lot more zeal than maybe we have when we just kind of we miss that point. But the other challenge that we have is when we don't really see the role that Christ wants us to fulfill, then it's very hard to be motivated. If you've ever been in a job where you felt very unmotivated at your work, there's probably a number of things that can cause that. One of the things that can cause that is when you don't know what it is you're supposed to do. If you've ever been in one of those companies where they don't really give you a lot of direction and you're not really sure if you're supposed to do that or the other guy's supposed to do that, you're not even sure if that's even supposed to get done or if it matters if it does get done or doesn't get done. In that kind of situation, there is no motivation. And there's a lot of companies that operate that way. I remember talking to a guy who he had just gotten a new job, and the first week they got him in there and they gave him his desk, but they didn't really have his computer set up yet, and they didn't have time to train him, and they said, you know, we're really busy here, we'll get stuff for you to do here soon. And for the whole first couple weeks, he just sat there and didn't have much to do. And his motivation was, it was not a good way to start a company. And a lot of times that's how it is for people at work, and sometimes that's how it is for people as Christians. Now you contrast that with what really makes you feel motivated at work is when your boss comes to you and says, all right, we've got this big deadline. In 2 weeks, we have to have this done. But I believe in you. I know you can get this done. And so it's depending on you. Work hard and make sure we hit that 2-week deadline. That's when you're motivated to say, yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to put in the overtime. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to make that, to hit that deadline. Because you see your role, it's clear, and you say, I know what I need to do to get to here. So this morning, I want to talk about seeing our roles as Christians. Because a lot of times, we're much more in that first category where, I know I need to serve God, and I'll try to do that. But there's no motivation because I don't say, okay, here's where I need to be at. Here's what I need to be accomplishing. Let's get there. And so over time, I come to church. I go home. I pray. But there's not really that zeal. That's what we're after. Now, here's how we're going to do this. It's kind of a different way. We're going to do it from the book of Esther. So turn back to Esther, a book that is I really don't preach on very often, but really hits this point perfectly. So, Esther. Esther is one of those great heroes of the Old Testament. One of those people who, when you line up all the great stories of the people who just really did God's will, Esther's right in there with them. What's different about her is some of the challenges she faced were a little bit different. Some of the ways that her story was formed is a little bit different. As we're going to see, one of the things that makes this book very strange is it is the only book of the entire Bible where the word God is never mentioned. The only book where God is never mentioned in the whole book. Very strange way to write a book of the Bible. But I think we're going to see a reason for that. Now, Esther, as you kind of go through it, kind of set up the scene here, as you're probably all familiar with the story, it starts out with the king. He ends up divorcing his wife and then decides he wants to marry someone else. And so he sends out these messengers through the whole land who are trying to find someone who he's going to marry. Esther's situation is she's a Jew living in Persia. Persia is not a Jewish city. So here she and her cousin Mordecai, who are Jews, are living in this city that is not Jewish. What would probably be a very difficult situation where they probably don't fit in exactly. And throughout the story, in certain places, you see that people don't even realize that they're Jews. People don't even know that there's a difference there. And sometimes that becomes a problem when people do realize that there's a difference there. So here we have these two, we might say, immigrants, these people who were taken, I mean, it dates back to when they were taken there in captivity, but here's these two people who don't really fit in. They're living in this city of Persia, and we have this great story of Esther's rise from being this immigrant to being queen of the land. And the way that all works is the king sends out these messengers, find me a new queen, and they take in all these girls from all these different places, and then they have this big sort of contest thing, and Esther wins. And here she is, who was this total nobody, and all of a sudden, she's the queen of all the land. So here's this incredible path to power that she has. And that just sets the scene for the story. That's just the beginning. Starts out with this incredible beginning. But before we really get into Esther, I want to talk about Mordecai. Let's talk about the zeal of Mordecai. As you continue through this story, we meet another character named Haman. So Haman is a guy who's also promoted to power. He is promoted to be second in command of the king, and the king makes this order that because he's in such a high office, everybody has to bow down before Haman. Well, as we're going to see, Mordecai doesn't. Chapter 3, verse 1. Esther chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants, who were at the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. Okay, what kind of guy do you see Mordecai as being? Here's a guy who, at first, he's just doing his job. He's just kind of there at the king's gate like he's supposed to be. That's where his job was, doing what he's supposed to do. And then along comes Haman, and there's the order. You've got to bow down to it. And for some reason, Mordecai doesn't. And that's the big question at first. Why doesn't he bow down? And it's not exactly explained here. It doesn't say, well, he didn't bow down because of this, this, and this. The only explanation he gives, it says the people were asking him, and finally it says they went and they told Haman, and all that they could tell Haman was, he says he's a Jew. That was the reason he gave this. I'm a Jew, and that's why I don't do it. Well, if we try to put all these things together, if we're going to say, well, why would a Jew not want to bow down to this man? The biggest thing that I could see is that this would probably indicate some kind of worship towards this guy. And that's not good. That's the very first commandment, is you'll only worship God. And so that may be the direction that this was going, that Mordecai in some way saw, all right, if I do this, I'm going to be compromising the very first of the Ten Commandments. That may be what was happening here. Now, the problem is I put a maybe in there. And I think a lot of times when I have to put a maybe in, that's where if I'm in a difficult situation and I'm like, maybe it's wrong, what am I going to do? Well, am I going to risk my life and almost get killed because maybe it's wrong? No, I think I'll just bow down. That'd be a lot easier. That's how most people would handle that situation. That's not the way Mordecai handles it. Another big question here is, it seems like Haman puts all this pressure on Mordecai. It seems like Haman is, it's all about, I've got to kill Mordecai first. What about, wouldn't you think there'd be like two or three other people who'd have the same dilemma and wouldn't bow down to him? But there's no mention of that. It seems like Mordecai's the one who has the conscience that says, I can't do this, and stays true to it and doesn't do it. Now, there had to be other Jews. We find out there were other Jews in this area. So maybe Mordecai's the one standing up, even when a lot of other Jews aren't. All right, what do you think about this kind of a guy? Here's a guy who is not passive. He's not the kind of guy who just kind of ducks into the shadows and maybe he won't notice me. He's not the kind of guy who, all right, I'll just do my job, I'll go ahead and do it just because I don't want to get myself in trouble. This is a guy who has courage. I mean, can you imagine the kind of courage this guy has? This is not just you standing up to your boss and saying, I know you told me to lie about these numbers so we can get the sale, I can't do that because I'm a Christian. This is a little more than just lose your job. This is about the king commanded this, and when you don't follow the king's command, you die, and I'm not going to follow the king's command. That's the kind of courage this guy has here. That's why we can plug in the word at the top there, zeal. That's the kind of zeal that Mordecai seems to have here. And it seems to go back to this very clear identity. I'm a Jew. That's why I behave in a certain way. He knew who he was, and therefore, that's the reason why I'm going to be different. Okay, that's the little story of Mordecai here at the beginning. What's sad is it doesn't work out well. I mean, he doesn't bow down, and we think, all right, someone's standing up and doing what's right. And the next thing you know, Haman goes to the king, and he doesn't get just permission to kill Mordecai. He decides, I want to kill all the Jews. And he forms this huge, elaborate plan that he's going to take out the whole entire nation. And that's what you have here in verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Wow. So now we're in trouble. And it feels like at the beginning of this book, why would you stand up? If this is teaching us anything, it feels like it's teaching us, well, if you do the right thing, you're going to get punished. Well, that's not good. So what's going to happen here? And that's where we have to keep reading. So now we're in real trouble. Now he's got to send out these letters. What happens is he goes to the king. He talks to him and he tells him, I've got this plan. Why don't we kill out all this group of people? And the king's totally okay with it. So they send out these letters throughout the whole land saying on this specific day, they set this special day. It's quite a ways off into the future. They set the special day. On this day, we're just going to massacre, just genocide this whole entire group of people. That's the plan. And here's what's interesting. At the end of that chapter, there's this interesting verse. At the end of verse 15, it says, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Here's the picture. Here's the king and Haman, and they're just sitting there drinking, and the city is in chaos at what they've just done. These two pictures, life in the palace, life on the street. Chaos is ensuing. All right, that's when we start getting towards Esther. Let's talk about Esther's response. In chapter 4, Mordecai's very concerned. He's concerned about that they're about to kill all the people. And so in chapter 4, verse 1, here's what happens. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes, and he put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. All right, so that's life outside the palace out here. And here's the way I'm trying to depict this. You've got all the out here, out in this darkness out in the street. Everything's in chaos. The Jews are ripping their clothes apart. They're laying in ashes. This is terrible. And then you have this little bubble. here's Esther, right here in this nice palace. Everything's good there. Look what happens with Esther. Verse 4. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. You get the impression here, Esther has no idea. She finds out that Haman's there with his clothes ripped up, and she's like, that's weird. Let's send him some new clothes. Like, she hasn't heard about this law. She has no idea. And so here she's, I mean, it's not her fault, but here she's in this little palace, and everything else is just falling apart. All right, so what are we going to do about this? Here, let me do this little depiction here. Here we've got, everything's fine here. Everything's not so good. Just kind of show the contrast there. Now, let's think about Esther a little bit and her life. Esther's life has pretty much gone with the flow this whole time. Very few choices, it seems like, in Esther's life she's gotten to make that really make a huge impact on the direction of her life. It didn't seem like she got picked, I want to be queen. It was the servants of the king came and got her and said, hey, we want you to do this, and then she went to it, and the next thing she knows, she's king and queen, and it's kind of just this, bam, 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 her life just kind of goes, and that's what happens, and she just kind of goes with this flow here. And so far, that seems to be kind of where, what, not because of anything of her, that's just the way her life has gone, and here she is in this totally different world here, and she's living in this kind of this whole different scenario than everything else. Verse 5. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai and to learn what this was and why it was. So she sends out somebody, a messenger, out to Mordecai to find out, hey, what's going on here? Here, let's learn what's going on. Okay, here, I want to talk a little bit about the challenge we're dealing with. Here's a problem that needs to be fixed. And here's Esther, who, as we're going to find out, is the one person who seems like the person who can fix it. And at this point, she's oblivious. Now, again, it's not her fault, but at this point, she's oblivious. So, what do we do when we're in this kind of situation where there's this challenge in front of us? There's something, some work that needs to be done, and I don't even know about it. That's just where it started with Esther. So the first thing she does is she tries to find out about the situation. She sends out this messenger to find out. And here's what happens, verse 6. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay in the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for the destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. Okay, so the first thing she does is she goes and she wants to learn what the problem is. Learns about this situation out here. And a lot of times, you and I are in that kind of a situation where I'm just kind of living my life, doing my thing, and I'm kind of oblivious to the fact that there are things that need to be dealt with, that there's problems, that there's people who need some help, that there's someone who needs some encouragement, and I'm the palace. Things are good in my life. What are you talking about? And so the first thing is seeing that problem. It may be in my family. Seeing that my kids are kind of, you know, I go to work and come home, and my kids are kind of neglected. I just don't really do the things that God wanted me to do with my kids. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's in the church, maybe it's realizing that there's a guy right in the pew right behind me who really needs some help right now, really needs that, some teaching or spiritual encouragement, and I never turned around and even noticed. All those kinds of things. Maybe it's seeing something out in the world, seeing that there are people around me who are dying in sin, and I'm just do my job here, or do this there, and I didn't notice that there's all this going on. There's the ensuing battle that's taking place, and I missed it. Alright, so the first thing is, open my eyes and see that. Second thing that Mordecai really tries to do, and he's giving her a lot of details, trying to help her understand the situation really in depth. Here's what the decree was, here's the money, here's how that all worked. Then he says, and you, Esther. Makes it personal. He says, in verse 8, Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued to Susa for the instruction that he might show to Esther and explain to her and command her to go and beg favor of the king. You, Esther, you need to do this. Now that's, I may be okay with step one. Step two is where most people fail. Where it starts out with, I see there's a problem. Man, there's this big problem in the church over there and it's so bad. I'm the one that's supposed to fix it? What? Me? Man, my marriage is a mess. Me? I'm supposed to fix it? I thought my wife was supposed to fix my marriage. You know, that over and over again, there's so many things where once it comes to me taking personal responsibility, that's where I dropped the ball. But that's where Mordecai really hits it hard and says, you, Esther, you're personally the one who needs to fix it. This is your role right now. Now, as soon as we do that, here's what almost always happens. I find a whole bunch of reasons why that's not true. And that's exactly what Esther did. Verse 10. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. So Esther says, hey, Mordecai, you don't understand this. You really don't understand the situation. You're saying, I need to go into the king. You act like I can just walk right into the king whenever I want to. That is not the way that works. And she says, everybody knows this. She says, everybody in all the provinces understands this, Mordecai. This is easy. Everybody knows that if you just walk into the king's presence and you haven't been invited, you're dead. It's not like I can do that. I may be the queen, but even I can't do that. The only way you can do that is if he holds out his scepter, and if he doesn't hold out his scepter, you die. And then she says, and don't you say to me that, oh, he likes you so much, I'm sure he'll hold out his scepter. I don't think we're on really good terms right now. I mean, he hasn't even seen me in 30 days. I haven't seen this guy in a month. Do you really think he's going to want me just interrupting his life right now? I don't think it's going to work, Mordecai. Now, that is where we are so often, where I may see the problem. I may see that that it kind of pertains to me a little bit, but then as soon as I see that, I say, but because of all these things, I can't do that. I don't have that talent. I don't have that ability. Here's what would mess up. Here's what would go wrong. I'm sure there's somebody else who could do it and not me. And that's where I just erase my name off that roll right there. That's not me. And Mordecai doesn't let her do that. Here's what Mordecai says. Verse 12. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. That is the great statement of the book of Esther. So here's what he says. He says, first of all, don't think that just because you're in the palace, everything's going to be okay. It's not. You're going to die too. But then he says, think about it this way. First of all, there's some trust in God here. Even though he doesn't mention the name God, he says, you know what? I'm pretty sure that if you don't do anything, God's not going to let his whole entire nation perish. Mordecai has enough faith in all the promises God's made. God's going to work it out. God's going to take care of things. But, he says, but you're going to perish because you didn't do what you're supposed to do. And then, here's the big thing, he says, who knows if you didn't come into power for just this moment? Here's the key to all of this. Here's where he's trying to get her to see that maybe God's had a hand in all of this. I mean, how was it that you just kind of went from being a peasant to being a queen? Maybe God's somehow been behind all of this working. And that's the beauty of the book of Esther, is that God's never mentioned, and yet you see God, I mean, on every page of the book, did you see God lining up everything just exactly right? And here's Mordecai bringing that out. Who knows that maybe all the lines are converging right now, and it's all pointing to you, Esther. That this is your moment where you're supposed to step onto the stage and you're supposed to say your line. That as God's written the story, that's where he wants it to go next. Maybe that, Esther. Now, I love the fact that it's a maybe. Who knows? Maybe. He doesn't say, I know for sure, but he says, maybe. And that's a lot of the way it works when we think about how God does things. Well, maybe God's working it to where this is the opportunity where I need to go and talk to this person about the gospel. Maybe. I mean, I don't know for sure that when I do that, they're going to become a Christian, but maybe that's what God really intends for me to do right now. I'll go do that. And that's how Mordecai sees this. Now, the key to this is really seeing God's hand throughout history. A lot of times, it's much easier to see things the way Esther saw them. There's this big contrast between the way Esther sees life and the way Mordecai sees life. Esther sees it as, you know, it's just the way situations happen. That now the Jews are going to die, that's bad. But, you know, if I went there and I talked to the king, I'd die, that'd be bad. You know, there's just these situations, they just kind of happen. Mordecai sees something much bigger. He says, what about maybe this is happening so that God can work this great plan and it can do all this? Maybe that's why this is all happening. That he sees God's hand at work. And that is one of the great benefits, I think, of studying the Old Testament. Because the Old Testament gives us a huge span of years that we read over. From Genesis all the way through Malachi, you have this huge span of thousands of years. And all these different stories that take place. And through it all, you see God's hand at work. Sometimes it's specifically mentioned. Sometimes it's inferred. Sometimes you don't figure it out until later. But throughout all of this, you see, wow, God was working throughout history. That by the time you get to the book of Matthew, you're like, and here comes Jesus. And the reason Jesus came is because God had it all lined up for the fullness of time just exactly right. It's one of the beauties of the genealogy in the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 1, that the way God starts that out is, well, he's descended from this person, this person, this person, this person, this person. And you can go back and you can read those names in the Old Testament. And some of those names, when we read them in the Old Testament, we thought, I don't even know why we have this story. Why do we need the story about Judah and Tamar? I don't get it. And then you find out she winds up in the genealogy of Jesus. And you say, oh, that makes sense. God was working it all the way along to bring apart about his plan. And that's one of the beauties of studying Revelation. Is that you find out the plan's not done yet. There's one more chapter of Christ returning and Judgment Day. And so God's still working everything towards that final end, and which means God's still actively working, getting us to where he wants us to end up, to write that final page of the story. Which means we're in a very similar place as Esther. That he's working everything together, and there may be something that he wants me or you to do as a role there, and I need to be like Esther and say, maybe it's for such a time as this. Now, even once I see all that, there's a good chance I'm going to say, but that's really hard. How am I ever going to do that? And so here's three things that will help us do that. Here's what Esther does. Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for three days, night or day. I and my young women also will fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. She does three things here that are really, really helpful. I mean, here she's about to risk her life, do something that could very easily get her killed. And in order to do that, the first thing she does is she prays. And she doesn't just pray a little bit. She prays, and she prays, and she prays, and she prays. And that is a theme you see through the Bible. That when people are about to do something really difficult, the first thing they do is get down on their knees and they pray. You see that in Jesus' life. What does he do right before he goes to the cross? He goes to the garden and he prays and he prays and he prays. And it's so fitting. If we see that God is working through history and that he's trying to accomplish his plan, and I'm like, I think I need to be doing something for God right now. I think I need to be a part of what God's doing, but I don't really want to. What should I do? Talk to God about it. God's the one who's putting this all together. God's the one who's trying to work it towards this big conclusion. Doesn't he seem like the right one to talk to about it? And so she starts with prayer. Step number two, she gets support from other people. although she's the one who has to step up and do this, although I'm the one who has this role, although you're the one who has this role that has to do this thing, we need each other. And that's the beauty of the way God set up the church, is this support from other people. And so what she does is she gets all the people around her to pray about it. And then she gets all the people who, even outside of that, all over this nation, she's getting them to pray about it and fast about it. Everybody's working to help her, support her, to accomplish this mission. And there are so many examples you can think of with this. And you've probably seen it in your life as well, where you've met somebody who's trying to do what they need to do. And they're struggling at it. And so what they do is they get some help from other Christians. And that gives them the strength to do what they need to do. I remember a time when I was growing up that my dad taught a man the gospel and he was converted. And soon after the man was converted, he decided he wanted to teach the gospel to his mother. Now, here's a man who really didn't know very much. I mean, he was a very new Christian. But he decided his role was to go teach the gospel to her, and it's great. But he had a big hurdle that he really didn't know that much. And so what he would do is, once a week he'd come over to our house, I remember, my dad would teach this man a lesson from the Bible, and the next day he'd go to his mom's house, and he'd teach the same thing to her. And after a while, she became a Christian too. And so here's this man who's like, he knew, this is what I need to do, but I don't know how I'm going to do it by myself. And so he got some support from somebody else, and through that, he was able to accomplish the work that God intended for him to do. All right, step number three. She does it in baby steps. It's really interesting the way Esther accomplishes this. She goes to the king. After all this praying and fasting, she goes to the king, and he holds out his scepter to her. Great moment. Here's your moment, Esther. Talk to him. And she says, I was wondering if you could come to a banquet with me. Okay? So the next day he comes to her banquet hall and everything, comes to his banquet. And he's there and says, all right, Esther, what do you want to talk to me about? I was wondering if you could come to another banquet. And so he comes to another banquet, and then she finally talks to him. He says, all right, here's what's happened, and explains to him the whole situation. It was these little baby steps. It wasn't like she just came out there right at the very beginning and said, all right, I need some help. It seems like she's a little nervous to do it like that. And so she does a little bit, and does a little bit more, and it builds and builds until finally she gets the courage, and she says, all right, here's the problem. We are the same way, where there's a big challenge in front of us, and I see it, and that's what I need to be doing, but I just don't have the courage to do it. What I do need to do is do a little step towards it, and another little step towards it, and get myself there. Now, this is not procrastination. This is not where I put it off and say, I don't have the courage to do it. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow or next week. This is where today I do a baby step to get me closer, knowing the next day I'm going to do a baby step to get me closer, knowing that I'm going to grow and I'm going to meet that goal. That's what Esther did, and that's what we need to be doing as Christians. Where baby step after baby step after baby step, we're getting to where God wants us to be so that we can fit that role. Okay, let's put this all together. Great story of Esther. Here's what happens at the end. After Esther comes and talks to the king, he listens to her, and to make the long story short, God works it all out. The people are saved. In fact, it's a tremendous victory. The enemies of the Jews end up getting punished instead of the Jews. And so this is a monumental victory. And it all starts when Esther goes in, has the courage to see her role at that moment, and go in and talk to the king. Now, when you take this to the New Testament, what you find is that all of us have work to do. And I want to just, here's one verse, there's lots of verses you could show this from, but one verse that I love is in Ephesians 4, verse 16, where he's talking about the way the church functions and how the different people doing different stuff. He talks earlier about apostles and elders and evangelists and all these different people and teachers and everything. But then he says here, at the end of that, he says, from him, the whole body joined and held together. This is from Christ. From him, the whole body joined and held together by every supporting ligament. Ligament, we've got the analogy of a body. We've got all these different pieces. Grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. According to Paul, every single part had some kind of work. That it wasn't that there was just three people in the church that had a role. Paul understood that everybody in the church, we all have roles. That was the message of Esther. Here she was in the palace. What am I supposed to do? You've got a role, Esther. You've got a role. See that role and go do it. And it may be that that role changes the whole nation. And so here's a challenge for all of us. What is your role? What is your role in your family? What is it that God really wants you to do? Some need out there that maybe isn't being met. That God says, you're the one. You're the person who really needs to do that in your family right now. What is your role in the church? What is the thing that God says, you're the person who has the ability, who sees the need. You are the person who's in the right spot right now, who's able to do this thing that needs to be done. This is your role. The lines are converging. This is you right now. What is your role in the world? Here's a world dying in sin. Here's a world where Satan is warring against us. What is your role right there? What do you need to be doing? What is it that God wants you to be doing to make that kind of difference? Let's be thinking about that. Let's be praying about that. And when we do that, I think that will fill each of us with the kind of zeal that God wants His church to have. If you're not a Christian, then we invite you to come and give yourself to Christ, to have your sins forgiven, to choose that from now on you're going to put all that sin behind and you're going to follow Him with zeal. If you're subject to the invitation, then please come forward while we stand and while we sing.